Hey, are we on now? Okay. Hi. I'm Kate Job. With two. And I want to welcome you to the first fireside chat. Yeah, we didn't bring the marshmallows, but we do have a fire anyway. In a past life, I was a choreographer and theater person, so I tend to like to make a set for things. And so if it gets annoying, let me know. We'll turn it off.
Thank you.
So the idea here, before I talk about that, I would just want to welcome everybody and say thank you for coming and being here. I know it's like a Sunday night, and for some people you've got to get up and go to work, and other people study, and so thank you for your time. And I want to also welcome people who, I had a lot of communication from people all over the world who are interested in what we're doing here tonight. And so they'll be listening to this in the future online, and I want to welcome those people here too. And one of those people was Sylvia Canestraw, who's in Australia, one of our diplomates. And she said, it's very interesting that you're having a fireside chat and we're burning down here. And so just to... She said there's a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome down there and people going through a lot. So just to remember that that's happening, and it was came up in the conversation. So I'd like to mention that.
We used to have a fireplace at the lobby.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, the Pacific have just a little bit tweaked the uncle, and I think the second person did it.
Oh, right. We had a fireplace in the middle of the lobby, and people kept breaking their feet on it, so we had to get rid of it. It was kind of in the middle of everything. But
virtual fireplace is safer.
This one's safer, I hope. So I also want to thank Katja, who helped organize this and push me into it. She was the fire under me, and Caroline Spark, who originated these research symposia. And finally, I want to thank our four panelists, and Pierre Morin is on the end here, and then Ingrid Rose is next, Cass Robinson is here, and Joe Goodbread. And these four people were chosen by the pen from a pool of people who are very qualified to speak on this topic, or at least to begin a conversation. So I just want to thank you and acknowledge that there are a lot of people who could be sitting here too. I would love to say, just before we get into this, and I'm going to ask them each to talk a little bit about what they're doing in the field of extreme states, to just frame this a little bit for what we're doing. I think this idea has been coming up in some way over many years, but there was one dinner where Julie and Joe and I were having dinner, and we were talking about something, and I think it was symptom work, and I think somebody said, I don't work with the symptom maker. Was that it? It was something like that. And everybody goes, what? You don't work with the symptom maker. And the symptom maker, for people who are new to this, is something like the idea of a spirit or an energy that creates a symptom, or that helps, is a process behind a symptom. And this was like heresy. And we, of course you work with the symptom maker in process work, but what happened was that we had a very deep and exciting conversation about it, and we thought, this should be something that people hear, that it's not just in behind closed doors, and I'm sure that lots of people have these conversations, so we wanted to make a place where this can happen. So that's where this idea came from. So it's kind of a co-created idea, so I want to acknowledge that. So then we decided to have this one, this the topic of this first fireside chat. So the idea is that we're really talking about process work, process theory, and process work training. So that in at least this version of it. So we decided that extreme state should be the first one, and I want to give you a little bit of background on that. Recently, we had students who had taken their phase two exams, and they were, what they complained to us a lot about conflicting ideas amongst the faculty about what we thought of what an extreme state was or what the standards were for the exams and things. So we thought that this is something that we need to look at a little bit more deeply amongst the faculty. We did that in a meeting. And then we also thought it's a conversation that we should have amongst us as trainees and trainers and as and also the greater outside world, all of us. So that's where that came from. So our hope is to bring this into a public discussion. And let's see. I think one thing that makes me, I noticed a little bit of nervousness in my voice about it. I think that one thing that makes me a little bit nervous and that makes it a challenging topic is that it's one where people who have had encounters with extreme states tend to become other. It's not us. And so that, and when that happens and we forget about our own extreme moments, it can be really, really hurtful. So that as we're talking about this, it's a sensitive topic, and just to remember that it's really all of us. And so just saying that, I think it will hope will open us up to being open to that we're on a level playing ground. So I have asked the panelists to introduce themselves and to say a little bit just about where they're coming from, what they do that's related to extreme states. And so they'll each do that and what they think is important about training people in extreme states. And then I've asked the community for questions, and we collected a few of those. And so we'll talk about some of those, and then we'll open it up for questions from us. And I don't know how we'll do that. We'll have to see how exactly we do this. This is the first time I've moderated a panel, so let's see. Okay. Oh, gosh, good. Good to see you. Okay. So who would like to start? So, Ingrid, are you still into starting?
I could start.
Okay. That would be great.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I noticed I got nervous even thinking about talking about this topic, because as you said, Kate, it is a sensitive area, and I don't really feel sufficiently qualified to talk about it. Even though I've been working in the field for 25 years and have had probably uncountable numbers of people seeing me who have been in and out of extreme states, I still feel as though I don't really know enough about it, and I don't want to offend anybody by my ignorance talking about it. So I need to say that first. I think I've learned the most about the magnificence of human psychology and the expansiveness of our minds and psyches in my encounters with people in extreme states. And I found that meeting those states and interacting with them have been great opportunities for awakening my own creativity and my own expansive mind. And I was always really terrified of any kind of extreme expression because I grew up with a father who'd been diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and I lived in terror of him as a child. And so going into the field of psychology, I carried that with me. But the more I worked with people who were in difficult states, the more I began to see how wonderful the creativity and the depth of the states were, and became less afraid of them, and had to work a lot on my own fear of my own so-called madness before I felt open enough to encounter others' extreme experiences. One of the most useful things that I've noticed in working with people in difficult, extreme situations is coming in as somebody who really believes in what they're experiencing and who can enter that experience with them has been something that both I and also my clients have really valued. It's an unusual thing, especially out there in more traditional medical settings, that the so-called weird and wondrous visions and feelings and thoughts and images that come to people in extreme states are usually classified as insane, mad, and not really a part of our society or shouldn't be around. And so it becomes really valuable for somebody experiencing something extreme to come into an environment in which their experience is honored and believed and met and joined with. So that's something I think is that's really valuable for the whole field, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to be brief. I want to say one more thing.
Okay.
Another aspect which I find incredibly helpful is that particularly in process work, because we're so trained in being able to pick up signals, that even though one state of one experience, one state of mind, one identity may be lost to that person, we are able to find that state in the signals that present themselves and help that person reconnect with the marginalized or lost part of themselves. And that's also an amazing tool.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thanks. I wasn't cutting you off if you had.
No, I'm okay. Done. I'm sorry to end so abruptly,
yes.
But I feel that's it.
Okay. Who would like to go? What's that?
An example. I worked for maybe close to 2 years with a young man who was convinced that he was a dragon. And he felt that he had come down to this reality, to this plane, in a human body, but that he was not human. And he suffered a lot in society. He would creep around and be very embarrassed and ashamed of himself and feel very unfamiliar and strange, and developed this hatred, actually, for humanity. And he thought the dragons were incredibly wise and had answers that humans would never have. And he even made himself a dragon suit, which he would put on and wear when he was at home, and eventually would go out to the store wearing his dragon suit after we'd worked together for some years. But I think it was my believing in his dragonness that really helped him come to terms with somewhat more with his own nature, which was really beyond either dragonness or humanness, but something much more essential. But I could only get there with him by joining him and believing in his dragon self.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Pierre, do you want to go next?
That's a touching example. Thank you for sharing that. Do you hear me? Yeah. I'm working in a context in a community mental health program with Lutheran Community Services, and I'm there as a supervisor and a clinician. And I was just thinking, one thing that when we talk, we say we talk about extreme states. And if you talk with other professionals in the field and you say extreme state, they say, what do you mean? They don't really understand. They won't actually use that word. And because they come from a different paradigm or with a different model in the background, and often the model that is currently prevailing is a medical model where there's a certain pathology or a brain disease that causes different symptoms or conditions that need to be treated. And one thing that I think is a strength in with process work that we look at these states or these presentations or these processes on a continuum of different states from more acceptable or normal. What is normal is, I mean, it's a huge group process, but there's and towards more the extreme side of experiences. And that's why we use extreme states as to describe these states. But not many people will, in the community of mental health, really understand or use that word, extreme state. And for me, I'm working with a lot of interns, students that come and practice their first clinical skills from different universities in the city. And what I really appreciate being able to teach them is, in a way, an openness to looking at these experiences are not only something that is pathological or something that needs to be treated with medicine and psychotherapy or counseling, but as a experience on that continuum of different experiences, and that you can look at them and treat them in the same way that you look at more normal states or things. It's the same way. So you can address them or go into, like you said, into the experience and the meaning of the experience with someone without having to think only that it is something that really is pathological. There's something that is meaningful in the background, and that could be actual a potential or an opportunity for some learning experience and some growth, even in the most extreme presentations of with so-called psychiatric diagnosis or psychosis. There's something that is actually valuable and that gives a chance or an opportunity to grow or to learn something. Even so, for many people that I work with and that I think they might not be really interested in developing or interested in the psychology of their own process, and but having that attitude is a big, I think it's one of the main issues for me in working with people.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, Joe.
Hi. You folks are actually covering most of what I wanted to say, so that's good. Less work. I'm currently my main experience working with states of consciousness is Cass and I. Cass has invited me. We've been working at the Royal Palm Hotel, which is a transitional housing project in northwest Portland here. And we do a weekly group on conflict resolution. And the participants are all people who have either addiction or extreme state processes or both. And I think for me, one of the most interesting things is the connection between world processes and states of consciousness. And this is something that Arnie addressed right at the beginning with his book City Shadows, where working with a great number of people in extraordinary states of consciousness, he found that very often people's experiences were somehow compensations for prevailing attitudes or prevailing experiences in the social framework that they came out of. So that's been very interesting to me over the years, and it made me focus on the relationship, on the social and relationship aspects of states of consciousness, that if somebody who's in an excited or a visionary state is not alone in that, that happens always against a social and a relational background, and that to really unfold or join them in that experience, you need at some point to take the whole field into account. So that's something that's really exciting to me. It's a there's a lot of research to be done in that. But it also, practically, it emphasizes something that I think is essential to training. And that is the idea of what Arnie calls two-state ethics. That on the one hand, on the one end of a spectrum, there's a tendency to pathologize states, diagnose them, and say, you have this diagnosis, you have to use this kind of therapy, the state is dysfunctional. On the other end of that spectrum is a possible tendency to romanticize states and say that somebody who's in an extraordinary state of consciousness is, well, we all have all of these in us, so I'm going to say it. There's like something exalted or something special or something. They're teachers. Now, both of those things have a certain amount of validity to them. In other words, if I'm in a state that's very controversial socially, like I may have a wild excitement and I'm calling people up at 4 o'clock in the morning and telling them about my latest philosophical insights and all sorts of stuff like that. Simply supporting me one-sidedly in that state is probably going to increase my suffering. So for me, the challenge is how to really help all of us find both states in ourselves, both extremes, that in each of us is something that could be extraordinary, extreme, ecstatic, visionary, and also a complementary state that likes to drive cars and eat dinner and watch television and take examinations. So well, right. I say part of me says yuck also. And then, so this is a big deal because if you think about the challenge of helping these states relate to each other, then that to me puts a different ethical position on therapy. Therapy is not there to correct somebody or to bring them into line with mainstream culture, but it's there as one option in helping us to negotiate the different poles of our own states of consciousness.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Is that one on?
Yeah, that one's on.
Yeah, so.
Wait a minute.
Cass. Okay. I'm just saying your name so people know who you are.
Is it working? So I'm Cass, and I'm not a therapist. I run a facility with about 50 beds, a residential facility for people who are often very poor and who have been diagnosed with a chronic Access 1 diagnosis, which in process work we tend to call an extreme state, and who are dual diagnosed, which means that 75% of the people in our building have drug and alcohol issues as well, and very low incomes. So, and I'm not a great thinker. So
it's not quite true.
Well, meaning I tend to take everything I've learned and everything I know and everything I know about myself. I'm a fairly nutty character. I don't know how to explain that in better words.
That's great, yeah.
And then I just do what I do. And you know, working in the mental health field and working in the kind of environment I work in, and Joe comes down and we work together, teamwork's really important. And also there's a lot of different ideas and points of view that you may not personally hold that philosophy. It may not be handy to go to bat against philosophies that you don't hold, but working out how to work together with people that have a different viewpoint on it to provide a way of being and supporting people to have access to as many of their parts as possible and for their lives to be not so hard. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to be chronically homeless or some of the things that the kind of building I work in sees. And like I think Joe was saying, all that there's so many, when you're working with people that in ourselves and our more extreme states, there's so much you have to think about as well. There's so many social issues and oppression issues, and it's sort of like how to keep your eye on the whole thing is really important. And also one thing where I work that is also really important is bottom lines, knowing when there's danger involved, knowing when you might need to call on extra help. I think I just kissed it.
That could be extreme.
I feel sorry for who's next. It's got a little bit of glitter on it. You know, knowing when someone might need other things that can be really important. Things sometimes can get very difficult and serious and dangerous. So just sort of like having your eyes on many different things. And also things can be beautiful, and I'm just very blessed to work where I work, and
I learn
a lot every
too.
Day.
Yeah, great.
Hold
Thank
on
you.
To it. I have my own.
Okay. Thank you all. I mean, it's very touching to hear each one of you and your points of view and the personal experiences. I want to add one thing about you, Cass. I think you said you're on call tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My phone's that vibrating. I'll have to get up.
She might have to go and answer the phone. So she's in the middle of it. Okay. Thanks. So I don't know how to do this with you. I have a few questions that have come in. Is that okay if I ask the questions from the outside first, from the ones that I gathered? And I'm not sure how to do this, but I want you to pretend we are sitting in the living room and we're having a conversation. So it's like more like that you can bring in an idea and I hate to say it this way, but kind of briefly, the way that you would in a conversation where, you know what I mean? So I don't know how to make it relax. I wish I had a glass of wine for you each or something like that. Maybe you can have one. But I don't want to make it too brief. That's not what I'm saying. But you know what I mean. So that if you disagree with somebody, and the first question that I would like you to ask you comes from Bogna. And it kind of goes right to a difficult situation. It was really a very interesting question to me. Her question, she says, my question refers to the person with fundamentalist beliefs acting or speaking out such beliefs, like a suicide bomber or something like that, somebody who's very extreme. Would you say it is an extreme state? That's the first part of it. And if so, how would you work with it? And she goes on to say that she knows it depends on the specific person and situation. It's not so easy to kind of speculate about that. But do you have any general ideas about understanding fundamentalism or dogmatic behavior as an extreme state? Do you get the problem? The question? Okay. I don't know how to direct the conversation. I just wanted to say, if you were in the living room and you heard that one, I'd run the other way or what? Please.
Yeah, one reaction start. First would say, I would get the police.
Say more about that.
That's well, cool. I need safety. I need protection. I need to get the police or help have something safe. Protect me and others.
Okay. Do you think it's an extreme state if we address that first part of the question? Is extreme fundamentalism that would lead to something like a suicide bomber in an extreme state?
I think so. I don't know about a suicide bomber, but I have... I remember driving through Newburgh, and there was a demonstration by a fundamentalist Christian group against gays and AIDS. And I stopped my car and I went out to speak to them. These were young high school kids, actually. And I tried to enter a debate with them on the topic. And everything I said was blocked and went unheard, so that there was one position on the other side and nothing else could be entertained or allowed in. And I think that is an extreme state.
So you're saying part of the definition of an extreme state is that it's one-sided and nothing else can come in.
Well, I think there isn't an ability to sort of look at oneself and have a view or a larger perspective on oneself and what one is doing or the experience that I'm having. I have an inability to see that or be able to talk about it. And that's certainly something I noticed in these kids, that they were not able to have a perception of themselves other than what they were standing for.
So I'm not going to call in anybody. Just okay. Go ahead. It's a little bit like an examination up here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
Thanks, Ingrid. That's great. Yeah, I like what you're saying.
I don't know if somebody with fundamentalist beliefs is in an extreme state or not. It would depend on whether or not they had perspective and say, well, this is my belief and I understand that you have different beliefs and I hate your beliefs and I hate you. That to me is not yet an extreme state. The classical view of extreme states is that, classical in process work, we say that a state is extreme to the extent that somebody can't meta-communicate about it. And so that would mean to me that if somebody would say to me, you are the devil. I am the devil. So somebody says to me, you, Joe, are the devil. And I say, well, I'm also Joe. And then they hit me. That, I would say, is close to an extreme state. But if I say, I'm not the devil, and they say, but yes, you are, then I relax.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I feel like any time somebody's unconscious of something, that's losing a meta-communicator.
Okay.
Can you take questions on this point from the outside?
I guess we're creating this together. This is the first time we're doing it. I hate to hold people out, because it makes it so dead and, like you have to wait. So maybe shall we try it, letting in discussions? Yeah. So you were just making a point, Nicole. Did you get to finish what you're saying?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, can you wait until he's done?
Well, we're in it, so we might as well go for
ahead.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello?
There are two things on that one, I think. There are people online that really need to hear it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So rank, right? People are unconscious of their rank. Like they're unable to meta-communicate. Like I'm a white migrant or I'm a migrant. I don't know, whatever. I'm a something that has a certain rank that people don't have the capacity to meta-communicate about that. So why isn't that an extreme state? Isn't that like an everyday reality, consensus reality type extreme state?
To the extent that somebody can't or won't meta-communicate when you talk to them about it, that begins to look like an extreme state.
So, thank you.
And I think you're underlining something, that you're underlining a quality of states in general, that's often said that the so-called consensus reality or socially acceptable state of consciousness from another perspective looks extreme because people often don't communicate about their own identities. So that's true. Now,
isn't that also a time factor included in that definition?
Well, I mean, a lot of people who have a lot of privilege don't communicate about their privilege over long periods of time, and if you try to confront them with it, will not talk about it. So I understand what you're saying, and it's true, but I also want to say that one of the things about not having a meta-communicator and being in a minority role is that there's often a lot of suffering that goes along with it. So it's often in the hands of the person who's in more of a minority state to do something about it, for better or worse.
I guess just the thing that... I'm on the same kind of what Nicole said and Sonia, that I think it's just sort of like recognizing that I think many of us recognize that there's like ways to be aligned with consensus reality and have absolutely no meta communicator. And like when I was a kid and I used to talk about socialism and my grandfather said, you're crazy. That's ridiculous. There was no conversation there. So I think that's kind of the point is like there's this, that state is so-called not extreme because it's aligned with where other people are at, and yet in terms of just behavior and dynamic, it feels and acts very extreme, which I think is at the heart of this question of terrorism. So I don't really, that's a point that I'm really interested in.
Okay. Pierre, and then Kasia had something to say. Yeah.
I just also wanted to mention that for me what is also important is an aspect of kind of pain and suffering is something that is both easily within the individual itself who goes through it, all the family around it. It's, I think for me, part of that an extreme state is also something that goes wrong and that is painful and that needs... I'm hesitating because it needs help and it doesn't need help. well, there can be different point of view, but there's an aspect of a
suffering
process that is painful within mm-hmm. the community or mm-hmm. within the person itself. That's one aspect.
Great, thanks. Good point. Yeah.
I was just thinking about conversations with people who are thinking of taking their own life, mm-hmm. and that their ability to explain the choice has a lot to do with whether or not I feel it's a state that if I feel like it's not an informed decision, if they can't tell me why, and they're just like just down, mm-hmm. then I would think that would be extreme, and I'm wondering if it would be the same with somebody who would take the life of others, that if they have, I may not agree with the choice. I may want to protect myself and others mm-hmm. and have safety concerns about the choice, but whether or not it would be an extreme state for me would have to be, I think what others have said, how much they articulate about the decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know. So you're bringing in people who are kind of more or less suicidal, but without the ideology behind it. Is that, I know you work with people a lot, and you're still working with Project Respond, right? People may not know that you work a lot with people who are in those situations where they're asking those questions, making those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, whatever somebody's going to do, if it's going to put others at risk and themselves at risk, I wonder what their thought process is about it, if they're capable of having one, or if it's just an inability to act or an impulse.
I'm going to turn that over to the panel. Yeah, Ingrid, you're looking like you want to say something. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about, it's so difficult to really define in a narrow way, but there's something about, first of all, the temporary nature of the extreme experience, that it can shift so easily. It can be there for a moment, and then it's not there, and then there's a meta-communicate, and then it's gone again. That's one thing I was thinking of. And the other is, it's more of a question really about somebody being in an extreme, say for example a terrorist, that in my mind may not have the awareness of themselves in the state, but get possessed by the state, even if it's a momentary thing. And I think that's the extreme state for me.
Yes.
Okay. I am from Palestine, and you're talking about terrorists, bomb sinicide, which label them extreme state. But I meet these people, and they are just resist occupation.
They're just resisting occupation.
Occupation. Yeah. They are in normal state. They mm-hmm. have beliefs. They have concepts. They work in their concepts. They just want to be here, that we are here, mm-hmm. resist the occupation. We want our land back. We mm-hmm. want refugees to be back. That their message. Maybe you label them terrorists, but they have concepts and values, and they work on what they believe. Mm-hmm. If their beliefs are contra in your beliefs, that not meaning they are in extreme state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm so happy you bring that up, because one of the problems with psychiatry and psychology and psychotherapy is that it can unconsciously become an instrument of social control. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why the concept of extreme states is useful, because a lot of the values that are expressed in let's say, the DSM-4 style of psychiatric diagnosis are based on social constructs, which it turns out are relatively local to the United States and to Northern Europe. So, and there's always been a background of politics to these diagnostic systems. So I think that I love this conversation, and this is, we're not going to solve it tonight, but I'm so happy that we're hearing different viewpoints on that.
Yeah. Let's have one more comment on this topic, and then I've got like a sheet of questions that I would love to move it on to. Yeah. So,
I'd like to come back to what Pierre said, that if he had to be in a situation with somebody with strong fundamentalist ideas, who would call the police first. I come from a society where there has been conflicts between Tutsis and Hutus for so many years, and I've been in a situation where if you happen to be a Tutsi or a Hutu, and then you bump into a group of the opposite side, you can just be killed because of what you look like. If you look like a Hutu, you meet Tutsis, you can, they will just kill you. But there will be other situations where you can meet a group of people from the opposite side who are more who are still fundamentalist, but who are more open to talk to you, to know who you are, to know what kind of ideas you've got. And you can even have a drink together, and then you go home after that. So I'm kind of confused to tell when shall I call the police, or when shall I talk to them first, or it's difficult for me to find the
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I just kind of say obviously yes. I'm totally with you. There's a lot of gray area. I just wanted to also to say, with when there is a threat, I want to take the threat seriously. Mm-hmm. And the threat at times need strong protection and something. Mm-hmm. I am in situations where I have to, for example, when there's a threat to a person in our agency by someone, says, I have to take that seriously and also take measures or inform people that are there to protect people and protect people and ourselves as staff or the person themselves. That doesn't mean that I might be sometimes open to work with them, or it depends on how open I will be to work with them also. It depends. But I mean, I've been very open to work with a lot of people, more open than many others in my agency would say they would, criticize me to do that. But I wanted to stress that point also, that sometimes it needs protection.
Mm-hmm. Great. So,
I had a thought.
Okay.
When Huda and Dieudonné were speaking, I thought maybe like a war or occupation situation is in itself an mm-hmm. extreme state, mm-hmm. like of a whole nation or a whole region or whatever, and that gets us to do things that are that extreme that maybe we wouldn't do within a so extreme state might be. Could be a field too, or mm-hmm. something like that.
It's like a city shadow of the world, or something like that. It's
right.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. I really want to move on to other questions. What do you think? Should we stay with this one or move on? Let's move on. Okay. I'm sorry. Is that okay? Okay. There's so much that can be said about any one of these questions, and we could go much further. Here's a question. That came to me about actually the exam process, but I think it talks about how process work looks at extreme states, how we kind of divide up the world of disturbances. And this question has to do with why in process work an addiction isn't an acceptable, you know, somebody who's addicted, like say to heroin or something like that, isn't acceptable to bring to an exam. It's very specific, but I think it's something worth talking about. Why are we not like that? So that one of the things that when we work with the skills or for extreme states, we say that that's different than addictions. And why is that? Anybody want to talk about that? They're looking at each other.
Okay, I love to talk.
For those of you who don't know our exam situation well here, one of the examinations is on demonstrating your skill at working with a whole variety of states of consciousness. And there was a big debate. Is somebody who has a severe addiction problem, is that similar to working with somebody who has what we call extreme states? And there's certain ways that it's similar and certain ways that it's not. So, for instance, one of the things in addiction, if I'm in a state of great ecstasy about something or other, I think the world is beautiful and I think all of you are beautiful, and I just have to tell everybody about it, and don't try to tell me otherwise, etc. And if you try to argue with me, I'm likely to ignore you. Okay, so that's one kind of state of consciousness. Another kind of state of consciousness is, wow, I just smoked a joint. And wow, you look really beautiful, and you look beautiful, and wow, the air is beautiful. Wow. And you try to engage me around that, and I'd say, I prefer, that's a bummer. Don't bring me down. Sorry, apologies. But anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is that often in addiction there's more ability to metacommunicate about it. You might not want to metacommunicate about it, but usually you have more of a choice when you're using a substance or in the midst of a behavior, to the extent that when you're in addiction and you can't metacommunicate about it, you really can't, then that's beginning to look more like an extreme state. So I think the intent behind that was that you should be able to have some fluidity working with people who in the moment have a great deal of difficulty metacommunicating about things.
Okay. Michelle, back there.
So I'm getting stuck on the word metacommunicate because I have my own understanding of what it means and it makes sense with what everyone's saying. But from what I've experienced and know and understand of extreme states, the metacommunicating is completely relative to who is deciding whether it's metacommunication. So the person in an extreme state is completely sure this person is metacommunicating. But of course, part of a definition of communicating is you're interacting with at least one other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how much do you have to interact with that other in order for it to be an extreme state or not? I think I said that pretty.
That's great. That's a great question. Yeah.
I just want to comment. I know what is the value of having a consensus about certain ways that we behave and communicate. If there's a consensus. No, sorry.
you know, what is the value of having a certain consensus about?
If you put that on, it won't do that. If you like slip it on your ear or put it to the side of your mouth.
Sorry. What is the value of having a certain consensus about how we as a community should behave in certain ways? Do we want to stop on a red light or not? Do we want to have certain behavior? You know, this is, I think there's a certain value to that because we are a community, and part of the metacommunication is that we relate to each other in a way that is, that we understand each other in some ways. And if someone in a state that is different and will think he meta communicates about it, but there's no, I mean, there's only a certain people that will understand him or not. I mean, that there's a barrier between, a communication barrier, and that is part, I think, of the idea of metacommunication, that at least there's some level, a grand level of communication that is, that people understand each other in some ways. Does that make sense?
I think it's also, I mean, I agree with you, Pierre, and then I also wonder about, is it not also an internal relationship with oneself? The metacommunication is, am I able to perceive other parts of myself other than the one that's taken over in the moment? And can I acknowledge that also internally? I think for me is also an important piece of that. So the ability to hold not only one part, but to be in touch with more than just that one, I think creates a bridge then and a way of meta-communicating also on the outside then.
Does that address what you were thinking, Michelle?
Yeah,
sort of. Do you want to? Yeah, okay. If there's...
I wanted to say, Sonia brought up the issue of the time over which something like this happens. All of us have moments where we can't metacommunicate or don't want to metacommunicate. And the time when it becomes socially troublesome is when it happens over long periods of time. And then that's the moment when people tend to come to the attention of the police, or there starts to be major disturbances in the family, and they're likely to be exposed to therapists even against their will at that point. So that's why I always see metacommunication, I agree with you, it's relative and it's social, but this consensus reality thing is not something that you can just do away with quickly.
I have a personal experience that's happening in my life that I'd like to
In the interest of consensus, how about taking one that works?
Okay. Thanks, you. I was just in the hospital because, it's a long story, but it's hard to know where to actually start the whole story. But when I was a college student, I was up late at night writing papers, and I was excited about them. And I was also depressed at the time. And I was like I went to a therapist who happened to be like a mainstream therapist. And I was stigmatized. I won't say I was diagnosed, but I mean, I guess I theoretically was. But with that disease that they say has highs and lows. And basically, I don't think that was a correct diagnosis, but it's haunted me for 20 years. Mm. And it's haunted me in a major, in a very debilitating way. For example, I tried to be the patient that the culture wanted me to be. Like, I've tried really hard, hospitalizing myself a few times, probably several times, five or six maybe. not for long periods, like a week at a time, but that lingers in your life reputation in a very serious way, and can bite you. So in the case of this, and I will stand for it strongly, misdiagnosis, because I don't feel that I have acted, I mean, I feel like states of excitement are good and states of melancholy are important and all that crap, but I don't think that I was really, I've had to come against medical and legal entities around defending myself. And it's made me a little bit paranoid, no pun intended. but my kids might get taken away from me right now. I just had, I have two, I love them, and right now, these creepy assholes are saying, you know, because you were in a fucking mental hospital for a week last year, you might lose your children, and you can't be free, and you have to have supervision. You know, I'm trying to bond with a baby right now, and like, I have to have some, you know, it's hard. I mean, you know, I've been in, like, you know, these hospitals, they have like cameras watching you sleep and all that. And, and like, I was attracted to this whole, thinking that the students are, and teachers are, well, in sharing or whatever, but I was attracted to it partly because it was non-pathological, because the culture is so like, you are this and that's who you are, and, I'm sure a lot of people have had this type of experience, so I don't want to like drone onward and upwards, but.
Thanks for talking about it, Nicole. And it's just, I mean, just talking about
it. You know, it's so horrible because I even hate, you say my name and I'm like scared that it's identified with the DSM. Oh. It's so deep.
Oh, wow.
It's like, I don't want to erase myself, but I don't want to, if I cry out, it's wrong, and if I shut up, it is.
Yeah.
So, but, if, you know?
Mm-hmm. I do. Sorry. I'm just feeling about that. Yeah. It's such a strong thing. Were you going to say something, Joe?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here.
You can make that one reliable.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And it's interesting because while you folks have been talking, I've been thinking about my own extreme states when I had a psychotic break and the phases of it, like when it started and when it got higher and when I couldn't metacommunicate and when I was institutionalized. And I was like, when was it extreme? When was it not? You know, and suddenly I realized that I was, here I am again, sort of pathologizing myself. It's not by the label of the DSM-4, but it's the process work diagnosis. Like, was it extreme state or not extreme state? And it started getting me like, paranoid, realizing that I'm doing it with a new language. And so why, really wanting to look at why are we having this conversation even? Uh-huh. Why is it important and why do I want to pay attention to it?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I think part of what, can I say something? Am I allowed to say something? I think part of what, I think part of what you're talking about is something to do with what I was saying at the beginning about otherizing these experiences rather than, you know, like I do the same thing when I'm extreme. I feel a little extreme, like knowing how to facilitate this because there's part of me that wants to make sure that everybody gets heard and there's a control. And then, you know, but there's like this other thing that wants to, so I have these two things about controlling and leaving things open. That is like for me in an extreme state right now. And so I feel like if I don't somehow acknowledge that or see that in myself, then I leave it out on the outside, which I know is not the same, but I just want to, it relieves me to say that right now. But I think the otherizing of it, I don't know. You were going to say something.
Yeah.
I wanted to speak to this question of whether or not the process work concept of an extreme state is pathologizing something. Mm-hmm. And I certainly understand how it can be used that way. And for me, it's an aspiration or a goal to use it in as neutral a way as possible. But it's not always possible because I have a strong dose of consensus reality attitude in myself. And to say that I don't would be, it's just not true. Now, where I think the danger is, the hidden danger, is that if I support my own sense of normalcy by looking at somebody else and saying, compared to them, I'm okay. That, to me, that's the beginning of pathology. So if we use the concept of an extreme state as a reference point to say, you are it, but I'm not, and that I take it in the broadest possible sense, any kind of category, like to say that you are, I don't know, anything like sexual orientation or anything like that. If I have had, I have had flirts of being attracted to men, for instance. But if I say, I look at somebody who's openly gay and I say, oh, I get it. That person is gay. I'm not. Because I don't do this and they do that. Then I'm reinforcing, I'm pathologizing, I'm creating a category of pathology against which normalcy is measured. So that, to me, is the real challenge in talking about and thinking about states of consciousness, is to recognize that there's a difference between my making this category of normal and extreme versus the question of what's necessary to be a therapist in situations where people are having a lot of conflict with the status quo. Okay? So that's my base orientation. Whether I live that or not is another question. You'll have to examine me on that.
It makes me think about, you know, classification and pathologizing. How does one classify without pathologizing? You know, how do you name something without measuring it to something else? It's a big question.
Okay. Is that okay? Who do you next? Okay.
I just wanted to share an experience. I like what Nicole said about that. The DSM, I don't know if people know what that is. That's the manual that people use to name mental disorders. And I went to therapy at one point and then found out my therapist was on the DSM committee that wrote the that wrote the manual. And I got worried because I used to do this little thing I still sometimes do where I always have to count my fingers evenly and oddly. And she noticed me doing that. I thought, oh, here it comes. It's got to be obsessive compulsive or some diagnosis like that. And it was so healing, I have to admit, that she said, oh, we all really don't know what we're doing on this committee, on this DSM committee. She said, there's a lot of good brains and good thinking, and people are really trying, but it's a very growing science. And she was extremely compassionate, I have to say, about not diagnosing people, because it really was a science and understanding how hurt people are by the finality of the diagnosis. Wow. So that was really incredible to meet someone that helps create that and see that voice.
Well, thank you.
When we start to, I'm doctor also, when I start to study medicine and we have these categories of disease, we start to put it in ourselves, Like we have this phobia. I have this disease. Oh, I have two symptoms of it. Maybe I have it. And maybe this status about normal or altered and extreme that make you so phobias. Oh, I have two categories from that disease. I have three. I have this disease. I have that. And I want you to be awareness about that and not to go so far away from these categories in DSM-4. Also about addictions, people, they have three states. They are normal, they are altered, they extreme. Maybe they become an extreme more than us, more than normal people, because they use drugs that take them to this extreme because they want to run away from their conscious reality. They want, they have their problem or they want fun or, and then they insist to go to this state of extreme because they like it. But they are not all the time in extreme. They want that. They want to be, to feel that because they help them in conscious reality to run away from their problem or to have fun or whatever.
Right. That could be the beginning of a group process about that. Jiro, your hand has been up there, back there.
Hi, my name is Jiro. And I sometimes think my topic change and I feel all disassociated. I'm a little bit schizophrenic, or sometimes I try to focus and not quite possible. Then I think, oh, I'm maybe ADD. And sometimes I kind of relate a little bit different ways, so that make me maybe borderline personality disorder or maybe autistic Asperger or something. And then, and so on. Like, I have very, happy time. I feel one with the universe, and also I'm very depressed. Maybe I want to end my life, and these things happen. But I like to say this one. I had 1 month. That's about 1 month. The world was so perfect. Then, now I can say, maybe I just ignoring the part which wasn't perfect, but in that 1 month, the world was so perfect. Then I start thinking oh, maybe I'm a little crazy. Well, oh, metacommunicator there, but whatever. But in that 1 month, later still, just the world was so perfect. Just completely perfect. Then I don't know, one part of me still diagnosing me, if you're crazy, you're extreme, you have to have trouble. But in that time, I didn't have any trouble. And later, maybe, I'm not sure now still, I'm in the perfect world, I can metacommunicate or not. But as far as I remember, that 1 month still didn't have trouble. So I feel very extreme, and that was so crazy. Actually, that was so perfect. Just, I wanted to share.
You look happy.
Extreme. Thank you.
I was thinking about that, yeah.
Thank you.
I
think you're also talking about where we can say about pathologizing or creating categories and things, but we all try to name different processes to make sense of them by putting a name of trying to understand and having a name to a certain situation or a certain condition is a way to try to develop some understanding about it, and having something, it's this or it's not this. It's also creating differentiation to understand and to try to understand the differences and understand the processes better. And I'm also afraid if we pathologize, then consensus reality, or pathologize medicine, or pathologize other processes that are in a way sometimes very helpful, and they can be very helpful to people as one aspect of the broad range of approaches to issues. So I'm a bit worried that we then marginalize these other ways that other people do.
I'm not sure I'm understanding you. We marginalize the the ways that other people do that, that like
in a way,
by pathologizing, we marginalize.
Well, there's a tendency in a way. I mean, there's a lot of suffering and a lot of stigmatizing and a lot of things that I'm very strongly against happening in culture in the way we treat people. On the other hand, the tendency could then be on the opposite side to marginalize what the medical profession is doing with people in these states and these conditions with medication that are also at times very helpful.
I see. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Right. I think that's right. I'm going to just like, I want to direct somehow the conversation to, I feel like we've gotten into an area where we're talking about pathology and that it kind of is, I feel like the consensus reality of looking at extreme or states anyway, the experiences behind the states is kind of settled in a way here, and I don't know how to direct us to, like, what's the point of focusing on states, or where are we headed to, what do we want to do, and, you know, like, to that it kind of overcomes that consensus reality experience of pathology, or it's so strong. Am I making myself clear? Does it make any sense? No?
Almost.
Okay. The feeling I have is that there's like this sense that there is a reality that where pathology is it, and that you can't go without that reality. And I understand the value of naming things, and that the kind of help that comes from that naming experience, so that people can be helped. But then I feel like there's also this feeling that there is this reality and we're kind of trying to work around it, instead of that reality is there. And in process work, I feel like when I'm working with an extreme state, it's not in spite of that, it's that is valuable, but then what are we doing here? What are we, you know, Ingrid was talking about it in the beginning, something about that valuing and the goodies, that I don't want to lose sight of what we get from those extremes in ourself, because this other tendency to pathologize them, I think that's what I'm talking about. Does that make sense? It's like how to keep the balance of that. For me, that is so powerful, that there in internally and also in the culture of that my hand is going like smashing something, like it's putting down that the goodies, you know. And that, so are you about to say something, Julie? You've got that look. Yeah,
the whole I'm not sure I can also, it's just, we're talking about the medical establishment a little bit too, just to go back to the pathology. I think that one thing that hooks me is also the communication style. It's not just what it does, but it's a certain rational discourse and talking about things. And I know that, I notice there's also different styles here too. There's like a much more feeling style, emotional style. It's like a real personal lived thing. And then there's also, it's a symposium and we're discussing different things. So I feel that that's part of, I don't know, what I start to react to. I start to think about the medical model or something. It's also a certain form of discourse. And I think maybe maybe makes us all paranoid a little bit. I don't know. Like, I feel paranoid a little bit. Like, there's this very rational way of addressing things. So I don't know. I'm just aware of it also. In this forum, we're trying to put two things together, which are really, it's like a big experiment to put it together. So, and I think that's one of the problems. I think that maybe, anyway, I don't know. Joe, you want to say something?
You're saying, what I hear you saying is there's something like a ghost. There's a ghost of oppression. That goes along with us. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah, it's like hard to have this topic without that
Yeah,
sort of
there's
thing
a ghost
around.
Of oppression, yeah. That there's a stereotype of the psychiatrist,
mm-hmm. right.
who comes with a certain way of talking to people, a certain way of acting on people that has to do with not listening, for instance, to the content of what they're saying, but judging the content as a indication of whether somebody is sick or not. So that's a ghost, but I... So your question, and I want to put that together with your question of what mm-hmm. are we doing here,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? So mm-hmm. the question, I think that the question of what we're doing may be relatively clear. We're interested in the meaning behind extreme state, behind all states of consciousness, but particularly states that consensus reality judges as meaningless or sick.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying that, no, don't change your view of people just because what they're saying doesn't make sense to you. Mm-hmm. People are still people no matter what kind of experience they're having. But then there's the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ghost that says, no. If you can't understand what somebody's saying within 10 minutes or an hour or 2 weeks, then you got to do something to them so that they come back so that you can understand them. And, it's not only a ghost, because I think in my experience, I'm going to go out on a limb, in my experience, everybody has a bottom line. Even the most liberal anti-psychiatric people have a bottom line. I don't want to go into it, but I can cite literature where people who have a very liberal view of altered states, of what constitutes a normal state or a meaningful state, will draw a line and say, beyond that, that's crazy, or that's schizophrenic or something. And I think all of us have that. I think ourselves.
For ourselves,
for other people, everybody's got a bottom line. And whether you want to admit it or not, whether you like it or not, everybody's got it. And for me, the real challenge is to find the meaning behind states, and including the meaning behind the relationship between consensus reality and whatever else is happening. The only person I've ever heard of who was completely on the side of, who said that the rest of the world is crazy, but the person in an extreme state is having a sane reaction, that was Ronald Lang. And he exhausted himself. He wanted to convert all of society. And in the end, it got him. It was an impossible, at least, and he had a lot of fire and a lot of interest in that. And it doesn't quite work. So at some point, you have to say that consensus reality is there, whether you like it or not. Part of living in the world is dealing with the fact that people come to a consensus about what's real and what's not. And I wish it were other. I wish there was a way to be an absolute individual in the middle of a social, if 5,999,000, et cetera, saw reality one way and I saw it a different way, I wish there was a way that I could really have that embraced. And I think that's one of the ideals. I don't know how to do it yet.
Mm-hmm. I think you just answered my question, because I thought, if I'm by myself, can I have an extreme state?
It's a great question.
But you're saying consensus reality is always there.
Either as an internal or an outer process.
Okay, mm-hmm. Because I was just thinking, maybe if you're just by yourself, it's never extreme, because there's no one there to say so. You know.
It's a great question. I don't know. Yeah. I have thought about that, but don't know how to answer it.
I guess the classical definition has to do, it's extreme within a culture or cultural setting, whether it's internal or external.
Well, not in the DSM. Well, not in the DSM.
But we're talking about process work.
In process work.
Yeah. So Diodune, and Killian has his hand up too. Okay, and then two over here. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to come back to what people have been saying about pathologizing ourselves sometimes. or being pathologized. And I was thinking about myself, for instance. Sometimes when I have depression, I feel like, oh, I shouldn't have this, and then I feel bad about it. But on the other side, I think if I can think of depression as part of me, as part of something which goes along with me sometimes, not every day, sometimes, I think that makes me feel a bit better. I think that's also one of the good reasons why we are talking about it tonight, so that we can remember that whatever we are is part of ourselves, and maybe it's harder to feel good about it, but I think if you can remember that, it can help.
Hi, my name's Killian. I wonder if there's, within process work, there's a sort of what I want to call an anthropocentric view of extreme states that maybe doesn't get recognized.
What?
Anthropocentric, a human-centered view of extreme states.
Right.
That we tend to look at extreme states, you know, within process work as something that we can understand. And we can get meaning of it, and there's a kind of tendency to believe that the extreme state is an expression of a part of ourselves. And I think that's right. But from my experience, going too far with that attitude is actually dangerous. Because there's another intelligence and there's another power on the other side that wants to be treated with respect. And it's really important to wrestle with it. And it's also important to be aware that if we think, or at least to speak for myself, if I feel like I start to master it, as opposed to wrestling with it, if I start to feel like this is something that I can get control of, that actually is a dangerous move, and what's on the other side does not like that. Mm-hmm. And it has something as much, I don't even, I mean, it goes beyond language. It's an experience, and it has a power that is meant to come to us as much as we are meant to somehow reach out and understand it and make it something that that we somehow can experience in our terms or do something with in our terms. Again, that's really important. It's not either or, but the other side is, what it wants. And it's real easy, at least from my experience, to lose that, because I want so much to stay within my own viewpoint and understand this, have meaning from it, you know, see it from a psychological point of view and all of that.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're saying.
Good, because I don't quite.
No.
Killian,
I know from my own depression.
Are you not referring there to the meaning of the state itself that wants to be expressed? Is that different?
That meaning, the way we talk about meaning, is from our, you know, from the perspective of, if you will, the small self. And it's a meaning for the small self. It's a meaning we make of this bigger something or this other something. But it always comes back to our terms and our understanding. And that's not the whole thing.
Right. Yes, thank you.
Maybe it wants to be experienced as well, not just understood.
And my own experience, again, is that it is a power in its own right. Yeah. It's us, but it's not us. And as soon as I start to try to just understand it only on my own terms, or somehow feel like I mastered it or I've got the whole meaning of it, you know, my own experience is there's something there that doesn't like that.
Yeah, got it.
I
love that you're talking about that. Great. Okay.
Hi, I'm Tobias. I'm getting a little, so it's a more theoretical question. I'm getting a little confused by the definitions, and I want to pose two questions to help me clarify it again. So one thing, what I hear from how to define an extreme state, I feel like I had two different kind of sorts of definitions. One is like an extreme state is an extreme state if the person gets in trouble with consensus reality, which is more like the society. How does it like the consequences it implies? And the other thing was internally if there's a lack of the meta communicator. And that's actually, I don't know if, and I want to make, how do these two relate, or are they useful, or maybe we use them for two different things, the word extreme, and that's a problem, because the one means the one, and one means the other, that's the first one. And the second one I would like to ask, if there is a concept in process work, would we call Don Juan a person in extreme state, meaning I've read, I found Ken Wilber, for example, helpful in that he speaks of pre-rational states and trans-personal, trans-rational states, meaning like they're states like which we say we are before because you lack the meta-communicator, and there may be states beyond, spiritual in a way, where you have actually grown beyond needing whatever, a meta-communicator, and just how do you grasp that, and would you put Don Juan in whatever, call him extreme state?
Yeah. I like it. That's great. I love how going back and forth between the personal and the theoretical, it's like our rhythm tonight. Yeah. Maybe we should answer these questions for a sec. Yeah, those are two. Are you answering the question, Tobias? But okay, so maybe we should focus on that first, and then you'll get more attention. Yeah. Anybody have any thoughts there?
Oh, I was just trying to go into the state myself and see what it was like. I was thinking of these deep meditative states where there's almost an experience of nothingness, but then there is still something there that notices that. And I think just from my little knowledge of Don Juan, that just his ability to notice what his experience was in all the different range of experiences that were possible is, in my mind, that meta-communication point that can observe. No matter how tiny it is, it's still there. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what came up for me there.
I do think there's definitely an internal and a social level to what we describe as extreme state, and when we describe metacommunication, communication has to do with at least more than one person or more than one part, because it's a dialogue between two different. So I do think there's actually, in the definition of extreme state, like you said, there's two levels to it. One is a more relationship social dimension to it, and another is more an internal between different parts of yourself.
We just want to add a little something to that. I don't see those two things that you mentioned as separate, the social difficulties and the metacommunication. I think that one of the observations is that if somebody, to the degree that somebody has difficulties metacommunicating, that's when they start getting into trouble with consensus reality. They're not separate things. You can get, if I'm always stopping my car in the middle of the street because I see a vision of something that nobody else can see, and I'm causing accidents and stuff, once, twice is interesting. If it turns into a habit, and it happens a lot, then that's a problem. And if I can't say, well, you know, it really is just a fantasy, and I'm going to work on that, If I'm really convinced about it and my belief can't be shaken and I'm causing a lot of accidents and stuff, it's a difficulty.
Okay, I agree with that they go along, but what makes me, as I feel they're both taken as definitions, and the problem with taking this social aspect as definition is the same that we get into the discussion we had right now.
So I'm not taking the social thing as a definition.
Okay. So for me, it would be like the meta, loss of meta communication is the real cause and the other is kind of the consequence that you observe. Okay, then I got it. I thought both of it were definitions, which puts us on the discussion of do we consensus.
The time when you'll be called upon to work on something as an extreme state, as a therapist, is when there is a lot of trouble going on, whether it's relationship trouble or social troubles of some sort or legal troubles, and then the person can't really participate either in estimating the kind of difficulty or won't participate in that, then that's a problem. Then things get very complicated, and that's where it begins to be a bit different from just conventional insight therapy.
Can was next.
It's another can of worms. I'll wait.
It's another can of worms? Oh, I think we're open to other cans of worms.
Worms are good.
Yeah. Go ahead. That one's more complicated.
This goes back to when we first started, and someone spoke to a group of demonstrators or demonstration.
You're too extreme.
That's okay, Will. Come on. Wait, save that for later. At any rate, one of the persons in the demonstration was addressed and unable to respond in a way.
What, you're referring to what Ingrid was saying
in the
beginning?
I think it was.
Yeah,
I was trying to remember
about the.
But it just occurred to me that the whole group was so polarized that maybe that whole group was in a state that we've been talking about a lot, and we haven't talked about that tonight. I just wanted to bring that up, and it reminded me of the axis of evil and the war against terrorism, and where whole groups of people are considered
other.
Extreme state.
Yeah, and marginalized.
Marginalized. I don't know if I got things too broad or not, but sometime we can.
What's the question? I think that's true what you're saying, but what's the question?
Is how do you deal with a group that's highly polarized? Well, we know if we're process workers, we know that process.
That's right.
So that I was just saying, is it appropriate to describe a whole group as in an extreme state?
If you want to cause more trouble than's there already, yes.
Well, I would.
In other words, it's a way of inflaming a conflict. And it's the usual way that we have of dealing with conflict, even slight interpersonal conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
If I say red and you say blue, then I say red and you say blue.
Yeah.
And then at some point, this happens. I say, I think you're crazy. If you can't see that it's red, I think you're crazy. This is the beginning of using diagnosis as a strategy for conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, as an old-fashioned group worker, had I been there and this one person couldn't seem to represent any other point of view, I would have said, does anybody else think differently?
Mm-hmm.
And
great.
Yeah. That's
great. Good idea.
So you have a way of dealing with it.
Yes.
Great. Yeah.
Okay.
And unfolding, I think, is one of the terms that we use for the individual.
Sure.
Great. I guess you're after. Okay. That's great. Then Dean.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I have a question. I wanted to ask Cass, but not only or specifically, but my energy is going there because you work in a place in the mainstream with characters that, from a process work perspective, we would call, they're living the city shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Agree?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I admire you doing that work for a start, all of you and anyone who's doing that work in a regular, consistent way, because I think it's tough work and it's something I used to do a little of. It pops up anyway. Okay. My question is, earlier on you said, I basically something about, I'm really glad I work there. Uh-huh. And can you say something about what working with these folk have brought to your life, both either as a person, a practitioner, or any of the above?
I don't know if I can, but I'll try. I think where I work, it's kind of like being in an environment where things happen around you all the time, and there are many different states going on at once with a lot of people, including myself and everybody that works there and people that live there. And I feel like what I learn in working I learn how to be process work and not talk about it, because I work in an environment where there's lots of different models, and it's mostly there's lots of different models. There's a medical model, there's the model I bring, there's social activism, there's all sorts of people with different philosophical backgrounds. So it wears me down in such a way that I just have to be and respond to things as best I can, and in the most in a way that I hope will be helpful, or if it's not, go back and apologize. And also be aware of making mistakes and being heartful enough to go back and try and clean it up and assault. And I mean, I have more privilege because I have a job than most of the people I work with, so privilege makes you blind. And so you sort of just sort of being humble about that. And also you sort of lose a certain sentimentality, because the reason the topic's so hard for me to talk about, I feel like, is because it is so interrelated with the particular culture you happen to work in, and also all the social oppression issues that are involved. And in a way, it's really heavy that there is a DSM, and you know, if I have a body symptom, it doesn't, you know, I have an extreme state. I have a relationship problem, but extreme states get so much more weight because of all the social oppression and diagnosis, and even knowing my own extremes isn't there's no comparison to somebody who has had the experience of having a diagnosis put on them, and the kind of oppression and shit that you get from that, as well as sometimes, I will have to say, on the other hand, when you're really oppressed and poor, sometimes being diagnosed and being medicated and being on Social Security can be a huge relief, and having access to medication that will sometimes make the day go a little faster, because the playing field's not level. So I just feel like it's so complicated, it's hard to talk about, and I just try and learn something every day. I learn a lot about teamwork in that kind of environment, because you really have to be a team player, even if you don't necessarily hold the same belief system. You need to hold your humanity and your friendliness and your meta skills out front. I want to thank you for talking about that. I'm also noticing it's about 2:58, and I know that people have things to do, and I promised Dean maybe we could use this as a way to wrap up. I would love to hear what you have to say or your question, and maybe would that be okay if we do that? And just that I want to make sure that people have school tomorrow. Yeah. Thanks for asking that question. That's great. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to say something about the extreme states that I and one of my nurses in hospice deals with, which is a little different than what we've been talking about for the last couple hours, which is people who are often nonverbal and very quiet in their extreme state. And Ingrid, about 15 minutes ago, you said something that I realized was my experience, although I couldn't name it like this. I think you said the state may be wanting to express itself. And so here's my experience this past week. And, you know, I've been doing this work for 5 years, and I can count on one hand the times that I've actually held the dying when they've taken their last breath. But in this one particular case, it very illustrates the state wanting to be joined or expressed. And this woman had her two adult daughters in the room, and they were bouncing off the walls. And I come in, and as the chaplain, oh, great, you've got the answer. I don't know. But I think without knowing it, what I was doing was actually their mom was quite peaceful and doing just fine, but they were, of course, very anxious mm-hmm. that they weren't doing the right thing for their mom. And they were just looking for every little thing they could do. And so I joined their doing a bit, but in a very quiet and deliberate way. And so someone was talking about fundamentalism, probably a fundamentalist Christian. And so we did place mom's Bible under her pillow. We did say that we would say a prayer. We brought the picture of their dad and placed it at her head. And in the slowing down, in the taking a deep breath, gathering, and even though they will tell you, oh, it was that great chaplain that did it for mom, it really wasn't. Before I spoke any word of prayer, at the moment of holding her hand and creating a circle and really joining that very quiet, peaceful state mm-hmm. of their mom, she took two gasping breaths and died. Mm-hmm. And they don't remember it this way. They tell my team and everyone they can say, oh, it was the chaplain. The chaplain helped mom over. But actually, it was all of us just kind of joining her in the state she was mm-hmm. in, recognizing it, mm-hmm. and there she went.
Thank you. Oh, thank you for that. Oh. Thanks. Wow. Thanks for sharing. That's like so touching. Wow. I don't know how to end this or how to sum this up. I want to thank our panel, who you've really been on the spot, and it's just wonderful. Yeah. Great. And I want to thank all of you and for being here and the discussion and questions that came from you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to Katya for carrying the mic. I just want to invite people in 3 weeks, which is a Sunday evening, March 8th, we're going to have the next research symposium, which won't be a fireside chat format, but it will be with Amici, who will be talking about trauma from a deep democracy perspective, particularly the deep democracy of the practitioner. Is that, maybe you want to say something?
The topic is trauma, a deep democracy approach, and particularly looking at what that could mean for the practitioner, whether you call, a person calls him or herself a therapist, a coach or a facilitator. But from the practitioner's viewpoint, what does it mean to have a deep democracy approach to working with trauma? So it's just some ideas to mulch into the pot.
Thanks, Amici. So that's going to be March 8th from 7 to 9. I know many of you won't be here any longer, but we do record them, so you'll be able to download them online like tonight's.
Yeah. And if those of you who are interested but won't be here have any specific questions, feel free to email me, amici@mindspring.com.
Thank you all for coming. It's been rich. Thanks.